Again, John chapter 12, verse 42. Jesus has been getting closer, or more precise, we might say, in his predictions of his death. Remember, he's used a lot of metaphors to talk about his death and his resurrection. He's gotten more specific as we go along with that. We have seen the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Remember that started in chapter 12, verse 1. It said it was 6 days before the Passover. And so we're counting down those days. Now, in John chapter 12, verse 42, where we left off, says, "Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him." The "nevertheless" comes from verses 37 through 41, where it talks about those who did not believe, who were blinded from the truth, but nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him. Here's a good passage to go to show that the Bible talks about different types of faith, or different degrees of faith, whatever language you want to use there. Because if we just stop there, if there was a period in our Bibles instead of a comma, we would think these people have a saving faith, don't they? That they believe in Jesus Christ, they're going to obey him, follow him. But there's not a period there, it's a comma that goes on to say, "But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue." I don't know anybody who would say that the faith mentioned of these rulers, or the belief that they had, was an acceptable belief. That it was a belief that would have been well-pleasing unto God. But yet it says, the Bible says, they believed in him. And so we understand that more than just this tertiary faith must be given to God. Now, what does it mean when it says, lest they be put out of the synagogue? What did it mean that they would be put out of the synagogue? Okay, wouldn't be allowed to worship. Doesn't mean that they would just be kicked out of the building or out of the structure. We would use the language today kind of excommunicated, that they would have been excluded from Jewish society and all of the things that went with it. It was a big deal. It was obviously not a reason to refuse to confess Jesus and to follow that faith. But yet it was nonetheless a big deal to be kicked out of the synagogue and all of the things and all of the trappings that went with that. And so the fear of that is what kept them from confessing their faith. Verse 43 adds this. Oh, I'm sorry, Mary Ann.
Would that also have an economic
repercussions
to it if
they were put out of the temple? Yes, yeah. Maybe not as strong as economic as we see imposed upon the Christians later in the book of Acts, but yes, some economic, because there would have been the fear of a Jew in good standing would be fearful for associating with a Jew in bad standing, and so it may have excluded some kind of trade because of that. And so you've got family repercussions, social, economic, so a lot of things at play there. Kathy.
This says many of the rulers, were they not in a position to lose economically being a ruler of in the synagogue?
Yeah, depending on what that's kind of a broad term, but rulers, but yeah, they may have lost their position of prestige or honor, or maybe even financial compensation for that.
In a sense, that's that same intimidation is being used today against Christians.
Yes, common tactic of Christ. And let's not think, when we talk about Christian persecution, we normally think of beatings or stonings or putting in prison. But the devil uses a lot of different tactics. In fact, the most common form of persecution that we read about in the scriptures is what we might term as nonviolent. Now, certainly we read about violent persecution, but far more common, we read about non-violent persecution. And so sometimes today we might say, well, we might even pray to God and thank God that we don't face persecution. Well, I understand what we mean by that, and I am thankful that we don't face physical, violent persecution. But we can still face this form of intimidation, of exclusion, and those different type of things, certainly.
But today, trying to keep the faith, but you're demonized and punished in many ways. The lady in Kentucky was put into jail for a few days.
Yeah. So this tactic still...
That's serious when we have the Constitution we have.
Yeah. It's still being used by Satan today. And here's the result, or the reason, not the result, the reason or the cause for it. Verse 43, for they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. Then Jesus cried out and said, he who believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. Remember, we said you could study John by looking at the themes that run throughout John. Several themes are picked up. This is certainly one of the major themes in the book of John. And really not just in John. It seems that John maybe highlights it more than the other Gospels. But this idea of him saying, it's not me, this is God. I and the Father are one. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I'm not doing my will, I'm doing the will of the Father. And so he says, he who believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And he who sees me sees him who sent me. This goes all the way back to chapter 1, doesn't it? In the introduction. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Remember, we talked about that idea of the phrase, the Word. He was communicating God to them. And so if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, he says. I have come as a light. Again, back to chapter 1, another one of the themes. He is the light. In him was life, and his life was the light of the world, John said. I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. And if anyone hears my words and does not believe, I do not judge him. For I did not come to the world to judge the world, but to save the world. That's another theme that Jesus has repeated over and over again, of saying, I did not come to judge. That, of course, is always clarified in its context. It'll be clarified here by the very next verse. But he said several things about that I have not come to judge. That was not his intent in his first coming. He was not to judge, but the Father was the judge. And now he goes on to say in verse 48, he who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. This is similar to a judge maybe today saying to someone who's been convicted of a crime that I'm not judging you, the law is. Well, now technically the judge is judging him, isn't he? But he's judging him by that standard. He's saying I'm not doing this arbitrarily. And that what seems to be what Jesus is saying in this context, that he is not just arbitrarily judging someone. He is not judging them based upon his own standards. Now, some of this language is a little bit lost on us because we have the benefit of not having seen Jesus in the flesh. And now, that seems backwards, doesn't it? We often think what a benefit it would have been if we could have seen him and seen his miracles and heard his teachings. But I believe in this context, it's a benefit not having seen him. Because having seen him, what was the statement made by many people who got to see Jesus in the flesh? What was their difficulty in believing him?
His appearance.
Yeah, he just looked like anybody else, didn't he? Is this not the carpenter's son? Do we not know he's just a human being? And so they had that obstacle to overcome. And so when Jesus says, I did not come to judge, I think he means that in several veins, but one vein in which he means it is, he did not come to judge as the human that you're seeing him. This is God who is doing this. This is the Word of God that is going to judge them in the last day. And he repeats again that same theme, verse 49, for I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command, what I should say and what I should speak. And so Jesus is saying any judging that's taking place comes from the authority of the Father, not from my own authority. It doesn't spring out of my own. but it comes from the Father. And I know that His command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak. That last verse, verse 50 of chapter 12, kind of interesting, the language there when he says, His command is everlasting life. He doesn't say, which would have been true, but he doesn't say His command provides everlasting life, or His command gives us the opportunity for everlasting, or leads to everlasting life. He shortens it by simply saying His command is everlasting life. Now, attach that to what he had said earlier about the words will be that which judge us. And so it's the words, it's the commands of God that are everlasting life, that will make the distinction or the judgment between life and death. And so again, Jesus, when he says, I did not come to judge, or I will not judge, he's simply saying, of my own. This does not come from me, this comes from the Father. Even the words that I speak, the everlasting life, all of that, he says, it comes from the Father. Now chapter 13 transitions, again, we're counting down. It says, now before the feast of the Passover. Many times the term Passover can refer to a day or to an entire week. And many times the phrase feast of the Passover refers to the week that's taking place here. But before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that His hour had come. Now again, there's another theme that follows throughout John, is His hour or His time. What has He said earlier in the Gospel of John about His hour or His time? It has not come, but now it has come. Jesus knew that His hour had come, that He should depart from this world to the Father. Again, John's Gospel, as well as Jesus' language from His own mouth, gets more specific. Again, this is lost on us sometimes, because we know, even His veiled language, we know what He means. We have the benefit of hindsight. We have the benefit of seeing the whole picture. And so sometimes that veiled language is lost on us, because it's not veiled to us. We know what He means when He says, destroy this temple and I'll build it again in 3 days. We know all of that language, what it means. But to them, it was very veiled. But as you see it, it's more specific as we go along. And so the hour, what did He mean when He said, my hour has not yet come? Well, we know, but the original audience did not know. But now it's spelled out what it means. The hour of His departure from this world to the Father. Another theme that goes throughout the Gospel of John is this idea of I'm going away. He says, I go away. To some, He says, I'm going away and you can't go with me. To others, He says, I'm going away and you will go with me. Not now, but you will go later. And so He's departing from this world to the Father. Having loved His own who were in the world, He loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray Him. John's going to use two phrases here to talk about Judas. Here at the first part of the chapter, he says that Satan, or the devil, has already put it into the heart of Judas. Later in this chapter, he's going to talk about the devil entering Judas. Strong language that we need to understand does not in any way indicate that Judas did not have a free will in this regard. But it's strong language that indicates two things, I think. Number one is, obviously, it just indicates the source of it, the source of sin, the source of temptation. Hold your fingers here and someone read Romans chapter 6. And I'm going to wait till I get over to make sure I'm telling you the right verse. Yeah, Romans 6, verse 16. Someone read that for us.
Do
you not know that to whom you present yourself slaves to obey, you are that one slave whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness?
Here, sin is personified in Paul's writings as being the one to whom we are enslaved, to whom we obey. In other places, it refers to the devil as being the one to whom we obey, or as the source of that temptation and therefore that sin. And so when John says that the devil's put it into the heart of Judas, and then later says the devil entered into Judas, it is talking about the source of it, the source of that temptation, the source of that plan and of that sin. But I think it also speaks, the severity of that language speaks to the severity of what Judas is doing. John doesn't want us to misunderstand the atrociousness of what's happening, of Judas' role in it. And so, in unmistakable language, Judas is going to be portrayed as the villain here. And rightfully so. He is the villain. What he is doing is the work of Satan. And so John uses this strong language to indicate that the devil had put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. We've already seen why that was easy for Satan to do, wasn't it? Remember, with Mary's anointing of Jesus with the ointment, Judas' objection to that wasn't his care for the poor, but it was for his own greed. He wanted to steal, pilfer some of that money. Jesus knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God. Kind of a strange statement, isn't it? A strange verse, really, isn't it? That he says that Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. What all things had been given into Jesus' hands? That's talked about here.
Knowing how to further the situation.
Talk.
God let Jesus have control of the situation that he was in on the earth.
Okay. Jesus had control over the things that had been given unto him, of God's plan. And I think that's what's talked about here is the plan of salvation that had been given unto Jesus. That task had been given unto him. And so all things had been given into his hands, and that he had come from God, and that he was going from God, or going to God, excuse me. Interesting statement about that Jesus knew where he was from and where he was going. That does not indicate, does it, that this is the first time Jesus knew this. No, Jesus knew that all along. This isn't new information that comes to him now in the week of the Passover. And so why do you think that's mentioned here? That Jesus knew where he was from and where he was going. Okay, he knew what the plan was and what his reward was. And that's going to be key in him finishing the task that's being done. And so important. The powerful lesson for us, there isn't it. Now, we can't know this in the sense that Jesus knew it, but we can accept it by faith that we know where we're from. We're created in the image of God. We know where we're going. That changes everything, doesn't it? If we know where we're from and where we're going. There's a sermon in there somewhere. But him knowing this, knowing that the Father had given everything into his hands, had given him the task of dying on the cross for the sins of the world, he rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. Now he arose from supper. Remember in our introduction, it's going way back in your memory here, remember we listed some things that John's gospel omits, that the other gospels include. What has been omitted from this supper in John's gospel that the other gospel writers tell us about? The instituting of the Lord's Supper is not in John's gospel. But John includes something that's not in the other gospels, and that's what's about to take place. And so he rises from supper, takes his towel, girds his feet. Now, what's interesting about this, before we look at the event, we know what event's about to take place here, don't we? But before we look at that event, think about what has just prefaced that event. Jesus does this, the washing of the disciples' feet, knowing, it says, knowing what his task was. And so this is a part of that. This is a part of his death, burial, and resurrection. This is a part of the plan of God. The timing of this is crucial. So he girds himself with a towel. After that, verse 5, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Now, we might be a little bit at a loss for this because of the change in customs and times, but what we're not at a loss for is that this was a humbling act. It would be today. It was then. And Peter understands that when he says he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Speaking in an objecting way. Peter understood that this was an humbling act. And Lord, sir, master, you're going to wash, the master's going to wash the servant's feet? Jesus answered and said to him, "What I am doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this." That's an understatement, isn't it? That's really true of so much of what Jesus has done and said. But Peter said to him, Peter, never wanting to be at a loss for words at this, we're going to see him at a loss for words later in this chapter, but right now he's not. He says, "You shall never wash my feet." Now, we're critical of Peter, of sticking his foot in his mouth sometimes. He was the first one to speak. Many times he said things wrong. We'll do a lesson one time that we'll entitle "The Good Things Peter Said." Peter spoke out boldly sometimes, and many times he said the right thing. We will remember the bad things that he said, blurting things out. But before we're too critical with Peter, we need to understand what Peter was coming from. We would probably have the same reaction, wouldn't we, if we were bold enough to say it. We would have thought it if we didn't say it. We might have been too bashful to say it. But we would have thought the same thing, wouldn't we? Here is the Messiah. We believe him to be the Messiah, the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies, the Son of God, the King of the Jews. And he's going to get down on his hands and knees and wash our feet. We would maybe say the same thing. No. Similar to the objection, isn't it, that John the Baptist had when Jesus came to be baptized and he says, I ought to be baptized of you. He understood that there was some kind of hierarchy there. And so Peter objects, you will never baptize my, or never wash my feet, excuse me. Jesus answered, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Then okay, he vehemently objects, but now he vehemently agrees. Yes, Lord, then wash all of me, if that's the case. Jesus said to him, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet. Again, kind of lost the idea of the custom of that day. They would have taken a bath, they would have washed themselves in preparation for the supper. But the feet would have been another story in the sandals and the dry, arid conditions in which they were living in. So he who's bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. Here's another thread or theme that runs through John's gospel, isn't it? Of Jesus taking physical, earthly things and twisting the conversation. Remember his discussion with Nicodemus. It was birth, wasn't it? Physical birth, and he started talking about a spiritual birth. So the woman at the well, he talked about water. It was a conversation about physical water. He turned it to spiritual water. In the feeding of the 5,000, after that event, he takes the bread, I am the bread of life. And he takes bread and turns that conversation. So he's done that several times, as John records here. And he does that same thing here. It's a play on words, isn't it? We understand what he's talking about here. He starts out by talking about being physically clean by taking a bath and washing your feet. But by the time he ends the sentence, we understand he's talking about something else. You are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, you are not all clean. And so he wasn't talking about just you're clean from your head to your knees, but your feet need to be washed. Neither is he saying some of you are physically clean and need a bath or need your feet washed, but some of you aren't clean and need your feet washed. He was talking spiritually. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments and sat down, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. What a powerful lesson. You know, actions speak louder than words. And Jesus taught in a lot of different ways, didn't he? He taught through parables and illustrations. He taught just by directly teaching. He taught in his miracles. His miracles were teachings, weren't they? And we've looked at that through the Gospel of John. That's another thing, that these miracles demonstrated something about him and the power of God. But now he teaches by his example. He is, we talked Sunday night about John 14, 15, and 16 in his discussion, trying to get these disciples ready through the speech that he gives there, the discussion that he gives. Well, here he's trying to get them ready by the example that he gives. I am your teacher. I am your master. I am your Lord. But I have washed your feet, so you also ought to wash one another's feet. Verse 15, for I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Why don't we see in the book of Acts and the epistles, why don't we ever see the apostles, Christians doing this? Washing each other's feet. Did they forget what Jesus commanded them here?
Well, when he was teaching, I guess he tried to show them that they were all equal and that they all were servants to each other, and that actually would be the way they would identify each other.
Yeah. They didn't forget it. They learned it, didn't they? In being servants. Ben?
He really wasn't trying to teach them the one who started feeding. He was trying to teach them humility. They probably have already washed one another's feet in the custom.
Yeah.
In those days, when someone came to your home, your act of hospitality the first day was to wash their feet, because they traveled in sandals over dirty roads and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That was just what they already did. He was teaching them that more to it than just washing their feet. It's an act of humility.
Yeah.
And they needed to learn that.
Yeah, and so they didn't forget it. We see this in their teaching. We see it in their actions, don't we, in the book of Acts. The Christians washing one another's feet by selling possessions and giving to one another, by their interest and their concern for one another. Through the teachings of these apostles and Paul, who would be added to their ranks later, that talked about putting another's interest ahead of their own. And so that lesson is learned. It's not forgotten. Yes, it's not a rite that he was teaching them that they needed to necessarily do this physical act and it to be repeated. But it was to be that they were to be servants. And that's what he said, that you're to be one another's servants.
You wouldn't expect them to be a pope either in that respect, would you?
Yeah, shows the complete misunderstanding of this concept, that idea of elevating one. Most assuredly, I say to you, verse 16, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. In other words, if you understand what I'm telling you, if you understand the object lesson that I'm teaching you, and they did. Again, maybe not right now, but later on he says they would. I do not speak concerning all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. What powerful language there, the heel being lifted up But now I tell you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe that I am He. Jesus, throughout this sequence of events, certainly getting closer to that betrayal in the garden, is going to over and over again tell His disciples two things. Number one is, this is coming. This is not surprising. I'm telling you what is happening. And then also is that He's going to tell them, and I do this willingly. This is not something that is overpowering me in this regard. So I'm telling you this so that you will believe that I am He. Most assuredly, I say to you, verse 20, he who receives whoever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. Remember, we said the theme throughout John is Jesus saying, I am the Father of one. When you see me, you've seen the Father. I'm not doing my own works. I'm doing the works of the Father. I'm not judging you. It's the Father who's judging you through my words. And so he has attached himself through the Father in that throughout. Now he takes it a step further in the chain of command, if we want to use that language. He says, if someone sees me, hears me, believes me, follows me, whatever language that he uses in the different context, is actually hearing, seeing, believing, following the Father. Now he's passing it on to these 11. Jesus has already said, I'm not talking about all of you. I'm talking about just 11 of you. That he who receives you will receive me, and in reality, receiving the Father. This puts Jesus' stamp of approval upon apostolic authority. That these apostles, and we talked about this some in our lesson Wednesday, Sunday night, so I don't want to belabor it too much now. But the apostles spoke on the authority of Jesus Christ, inspired by the Holy Spirit, which connected them. You connect the dots directly back to the Father in heaven. And so what they said was actually coming from the Father and carried with it every bit of the authority of Jesus himself. When Jesus had said these things, verse 21 says, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. Then the disciples looked at one another as we would, perplexed about whom he spoke. Well, you can just imagine looking at one another. Who's he talking about? Which one of us is it? Now, there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Who do we think this most likely is? John. Remember, John never identifies himself by name in his gospel. We assume that every time John loosely refers to someone, but sometimes I think later he's going to refer to himself as the other disciple. I think he's talking about himself. But here he talks about the disciple whom Jesus loved. Don't take that to be an arrogant statement by John. I don't think he's saying I was his favorite. He didn't love the other ones, but he loved me. That's not the point that he's making. Just a way to refer to himself without calling himself by name was to say the one whom Jesus loved. Not implying that Jesus didn't love the other ones, but what an affectionate way to refer to himself. Not saying, again, not excluding the others and not elevating his position in any way, but just an affectionate way to just talk about himself. Further that, I might say of my parents, that my parents love me. Well, that doesn't mean that they don't love my brothers as well. It just simply means I'm just in talking about myself, I can say my parents love me. And so when you read that, the disciple whom Jesus loved, don't read it in the disciple, that one who Jesus loved. It's just him referring to himself. There was leaning on his bosom one of the disciples whom Jesus loved. Now notice how Peter's tact has changed. This might be because of what's happened earlier with Peter being rebuked. Peter spoke up, didn't he? You're not going to wash my feet. And so he spoke up, Jesus rebuked him, and Peter understood that. And he says, okay, then wash all of me. But now Peter's not himself, we might say. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him, to the disciple whom Jesus loved, who we think to be John, motioned to him to ask who it was of whom he spoke. Peter's usually the first one who would have said, Jesus, who are you talking about? I mean, Peter's just the one who so boldly talks about things. But maybe because of the rebuke that's happened earlier on this evening, that Peter just somehow motions to John. Look, it almost seems to ask him. You know, maybe mouthing the words or somehow indicating to John. Then, leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, who is it? Now, the other gospel writers indicate that there was maybe some asking, is it I? Is it I? But John asked him, who is it? Jesus answered, it is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. And having dipped the bread, just imagine that in the disciples' eyes, this must have happened in slow motion, didn't it? As they were watching this, and he's dipping the bread, and now he's going to that side, who is it? And he says, and he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Remember earlier he had said that Satan had already put it into his heart. Satan entered him, it says. Again, I don't take that into anything other than to show the source of this action. I don't think that's any kind of stronger language than any temptation to sin would be. It's just graphically to indicate this is who this is from. Satan entered him, and Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. But no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. For some thought, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus had said to him, buy these things we need for the feast, or that he should give something to the poor. Having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately, and it was not. That's a little curious to us, doesn't it? We would think, again, we've got the benefit of hindsight, don't we? And so we read that. It makes perfect sense to us what Jesus was meaning. And Jesus even said, the one whom I give this piece of bread to, thee will betray me. But somehow this was lost on those disciples. It may have been that they just couldn't see it. You know, well, Judas wouldn't do that. You know, none of us would ever do so. And so, again, of course, they don't know what we know of what the betrayal means. You know, betrayal is kind of a vague word, isn't it? Necessarily. And so, we know exactly what Judas is going to do. They didn't. But for whatever reason, it was kind of lost on them as to what was taking place. So Judas goes out. You think Judas knew? Paul's there. It talks about the other ones not knowing. Judas knew. So when he had gone out, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified with him. Again, Jesus has talked about this before, hasn't he? Glorified in his death, burial, resurrection, and ascension. I take all of those to kind of be grouped into this, and the idea of being glorified in the sense of obeying his Father and doing the will of the Father. Again, I attach this to what he had said earlier, or what John had said earlier, that all things had been given into his hands. God has entrusted Jesus with this plan. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him immediately. Again, the hour is here. And I'm going to glorify the Father. The Father's going to glorify me. I'm going to glorify the Father in dying upon the cross. He's going to glorify me in raising me from the dead. Tim?
22, Judas had already made the deal with the leaders to betray Jesus.
Yes.
So he had already entered into it. He knew what was going on. So this wasn't, as you said, something where this just, you know, Satan just kind of got on him and said, you're going to do this. But Judas had already made the deal before the supper.
Yes, yeah. The other gospel, particularly Luke. Luke is maybe the best as far as the details and the sequence and the timing of that. And yes, that transaction's already taken place. Good point. Marianne?
You said you covered that term, son of
Yes. But not tonight. You're right. We are out of time. We're actually past the buzzer right now. So let's go ahead and just end. I think our buzzer ringer isn't here tonight. So we'll go ahead and stop there. But we will. I'm not avoiding it. We're going to talk about Son of God and Son of Man, those phrases that are there. But we'll have to do that next time. Before we leave, I want to do this other handout here. This is the rest of John. You may notice this handout a little quicker than the other ones, but this gets us all the way through.